Today we're going to look at the fulfillment of God's promise to the people of Israel to give them the land of Canaan, the promised land, the land that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob wandered through but never owned a part of, other than the little burial plot that was purchased there. And we've seen over the past few weeks that the Israelites spent a number of years, 40 years, in the wilderness as they became God's people after exiting Egypt, leaving the life that they had learned in Egypt for 430 years and learning what it means to be God's people. And then when the time was right, God brought them into the promised land and turned that over to them, and we'll see that today. We will pretty well go through the entire book of Joshua where these stories are recorded. We'll retrace a little bit of ground we've covered last week just to kind of bring us up and to take a look at the whole conquest picture, the whole gift of the promised land to the Israelites from God. Now, kind of picking up with the Israelites in the wilderness, you know, they were there for a long time. They were there for 40 years is what God said they would have to be there since the spies went in and checked out the promised land early after leaving Egypt. And Israel failed to trust God to turn that, to give that land to them. So God said, okay, well then none of you will get to see this land. Instead, your children will. So you'll wander out in this wilderness for 40 years until you, until this generation is gone, and the next generation will be the one that will go in. Well, how did they know when that time was right? How did they just watch their clock and say, okay, now it's time? How do they know when it was time to head north and head to the promised land? We go to Deuteronomy chapter 2. This is Moses recounting to this second generation. The book of Deuteronomy means second law or second word. And this is Moses' reminders and retelling of the story to this second generation. They weren't there when Israel left Egypt. The first generation had been there, but now at the end, the first generation was gone. The second generation needed to be reminded of what all God had done for them. And so Moses recounts this. And then he does that in through the book of Deuteronomy. In chapter 2 of Deuteronomy, Moses says, "Well, then we turned back and set out toward the desert along the route to the Red Sea, as Yahweh had directed me. For a long time we made our way around the hill country of Seir." Long time, that's many, many years. "Then Yahweh said to me, 'You've made your way around this hill country long enough, now turn north.'" So how do they know when it was time to go north? God told them. Okay. How do they know where to go, what to do? How did they receive the promised land? It was all God's gift. It was all God's direction. Okay. What's interesting, though, is if we look further in verses 14 and 15, we see how long had passed. How long had that time been from when they left Kadesh Barnea? Kadesh Barnea is where the spies had gone in, where the Israelites decided that they weren't going to trust God to give this land to them, and God had decided that they were going to wait out a generation before they came in. So how long had it been by the time they reached the Zered Brook, which is the border of Moab? Verse 14, 38 years passed from the time that we left Kadesh Barnea until we crossed the Zered Valley. By then, that entire generation of fighting men had perished from the camp, as Yahweh had sworn to them. Yahweh's hand was against them until he had completely eliminated them from the camp. So, 38 years. Now that sounds a little bit short of 40, right? Well, not if you remember that there had been a couple years, right at close to 2 years, from the time that they left Egypt to the time that they got to Kadesh Barnea. Most of that time having been spent in at Mount Sinai. Okay. Your last couple pages of your handout give you some maps that will kind of be helpful as we walk through this. Page 5 gives you the map of wilderness wanderings and leaving Egypt, and then as they come in, and as you see where they come up to Moab, on page 5 at the far right, you know, there's the Zered Brook down there. And so it's 38 years since they to get to that point. And then they go on. We saw the stories about how they bypassed Edom, they bypassed Moab, they bypassed Ammon, and then they end up, they eventually go across the Jordan River. And as they cross the Jordan River, talk about timing, what is significant about the date that God brings them across the Jordan River? If we look at chapter 5, verse 10 of Joshua, it says, "On the evening of the 14th day of the month, while they were camped at Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, the Israelites celebrated the Passover." Okay, so right after they came across the Jordan River is where we have this verse. And it happens to be Passover, time to celebrate the Passover. What was Passover? Passover was the event that got them out of Egypt. Passover, they're celebrating it on the anniversary. They come into the Promised Land on the anniversary of the day that they leave. And how many years is that? Well, 40 years. Okay, we've got 38 years from Kadesh Barnea and a little bit shy of 2 years to get to Kadesh Barnea. And then now a little bit extra time to get into before they get across the Jordan. So you've got 40 years. This whole generation, this 40 years that God had promised, we see it happens to the day. And what do? They celebrate and they remember what God had done for them over all these years. Okay? So you see God's perfect timing, the fullness of God's timing in bringing them into the Promised Land. The torch is passed from Moses to Joshua. We saw that last week, that Moses died. Moses, because he didn't trust God, and he acted like he was the one bringing water from a rock rather than showing God's power at work just through speaking God's word. God told Moses he would not be able to enter the Promised Land, but he allowed him to see it. He went up on Mount Nebo and was able to look across and saw the Promised Land. But he wasn't able to enter it. Instead, the torch was passed to his right-hand man, Joshua. Okay? And so the stories that we have today of the conquests all take place under Joshua, the ones in the book of Joshua. At the end of Joshua, we have a little conclusion, because as Joshua is kind of passing on then, he gives some nice Reader's Digest summaries of what's happened and of their story. If you look at Joshua chapter 24, he gives a little summary of the story of the Israelites he summarizes the book of Genesis for us. chapter 24, verses 2 to 4. Joshua said to all the people, "This is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. Long ago your forefathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, and Nahor, they lived beyond the river and worshipped other gods. But I took your father Abraham from the land beyond the river and led him throughout Canaan and gave him many descendants. I gave him Isaac, and to Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. I assigned the hill country of Seir to Esau, but Jacob and his sons went down to Egypt." Okay, there's a real short, no details kind of summary of the book of Genesis. Okay, God picked out Abraham. Nothing that Abraham had deserved. He and his family worshipped other gods. But yet God in his grace chose Abraham, brought him, showed him Canaan that he would eventually give to Abraham's descendants, but never gave it to him. But he gave many promises to Abraham, not only the land, but also many descendants. He gave him those descendants. And he blessed those descendants, even the descendants through whom the covenant was not to be passed. Esau. To Esau he gave the land of Seir, okay, the land of Edom, if you see on your maps here on the south and south and east side of the Dead Sea, the Salt Sea. Okay, but Jacob, the chosen lineage, God sent to Egypt for this time of preparation. And then Joshua goes on and summarizes the book of Exodus. Verse 5. "Well, then I sent Moses and Aaron, and I afflicted the Egyptians by what I did there, and I brought you out. When I brought your fathers out of Egypt, you came to the sea, and the Egyptians pursued them with chariots and horsemen as far as the Red Sea. But they cried to Yahweh for help, and he put darkness between you and the Egyptians. He brought the sea over them and covered them. You saw with your own eyes what I did to the Egyptians. And then, you lived in the desert for a long time." Real quick summary of the book of Egypt, okay? In the fullness of God's time, he sent a Savior. He sent Moses and Aaron to help him to go to Pharaoh and to get you out, okay? They got you out through God's mighty works, through God's plagues that he sent. But then, when it looked like your back was up against the wall at the Red Sea, God saved you in a way that there was no way you could save yourself. You had many years that you lived in the desert, and many times there were ways that you could not exist, but God saved you, and God allowed you to exist and allowed you to live. out of his grace. So you saw God's hand throughout all of this. Okay? And then he goes on and he summarizes the stories that we looked at last week. Verse 8. It says, I brought you to the land of the Amorites who lived east of the Jordan. They fought against you, but I gave them into your hands. I destroyed them from before you, and you took possession of their lands. When Balak, the son of Zippor, the king of Moab, prepared to fight against Israel, he sent for Balaam, son of Beor, to put a curse on you. But I would not listen to Balaam. So he blessed you again and again, and I delivered you out of his hand. Then you crossed the Jordan and came to Jericho. The citizens of Jericho fought against you, as did the Amorites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hivites, Girgashites, Hivites, and Jebusites, but I gave them into your hands. Okay? So, God gave this land to them. The land on the east side of the Jordan River, okay, the Amorite land on the east side, plus the land on the west side, Jericho and the others. And that's what we're going to be looking at today, is those stories. So Joshua gives us a very quick summary here in chapter 24 of God's word to this time. And what is it? It's all stories of God pouring out his love and his blessings and promises and care and provision for his people. Okay? Joshua is reminding them of who God is, of who they are in relation to God, how God loves them, how God has plans for them, and that all they are to do is to stay within those plans. Okay? All right, well, let's go back and let's look at this conquest. It really kind of starts in Deuteronomy when Moses is still around. If we go back to Deuteronomy chapter 2, we see, and if you look at your map on page 5, you see that they come up out of the desert. There's all sorts of different possible paths. It doesn't give us all the details. But you see they get to Ezion Geber. And you would think that the natural way for them to go would be along this King's Highway. You see the King's Highway goes north from there, and it would just take them right east of the Dead Sea and Jordan River. You know, either that or else they go to the west side through Kadesh Barnea, kind of like the spies had gone before, along the way to Shur. It would just be obvious that they would go along one of those major highways, but they didn't. You see, these major highways go through the land of Edom. They go through the land of Moab. And it goes alongside the land of Ammon. And God did not give them those lands. Okay? Before this time, before Ezion Geber, they were out in the desert where nobody lives. That's not land. That's not any place where anyone would want to claim that land. But as you get on up the King's Highway, you go through Edom, through the land of Seir there, through Moab. That's all inhabitable land, land that people would want. But God does not give this to the Israelites. This is not their promised land. Why not? Deuteronomy 2, starting, we'll jump around a little bit. Verse 5 says, do not provoke them to war. This is God speaking to Moses. For I will not give you any of their land, not even enough to put your foot on. I've given Esau the hill country of Seir as his own. So before they go through Edom, God says, that's not your land. I've given that to the descendants of Esau. That's my gift to them. Okay, they end up having to go around Edom because the Edomites would not allow them to go through on the king's highway. And then they get to the Zered Brook, which is the border of Moab. And then verse 9. Then Yahweh said to me, do not harass the Moabites or provoke them to war, for I will not give you any part of their land. I've given Ar, that's the name of that land, to the descendants of Lot as a possession. Moabites were the descendants of Moab. Moab was one of the two sons of Lot. Lot was the nephew of Abraham. So the Moabites, and then Ammon was the other son, so Ammonites, those were descendants of Lot. And God said, I'm not giving you the land of Moab. That's my gift to the descendants of Moab, the descendants of the son of Lot. Okay? As you go north of Moab, you cross the Arnon Gorge and the Arnon River gorge there. And then it kind of splits. On the western side, before you get to the Jordan River, you've got the land of Gilead, and there were a lot of Amorites and those kind of people living there. On the eastern side, you have the land of Ammon. And the Ammonites, again, those were descendants of Ammon, who was the son of Lot. the other son of Lot. In verse 19, God says, when you come to the Ammonites, do not harass them or provoke them to war, for I will not give you possession of any land belonging to the Ammonites. I've given it as a possession to the descendants of Lot. So those three countries were protected by God from the Israelites. This was not part of the promised land. This was land that he gave as gifts out of his grace to other descendants who had relationships with Abraham. Okay. So since these people were kind of considered brothers and protected by God, did the Israelites feel kindly to them were they like treated as brothers, etc.? Well, let's turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 23, starting at verse 3. This is some of the commands that God gives Moses, and Moses passes on here. It says, no Ammonite or Moabite or any of his descendants may enter the assembly of Yahweh, even down to the 10th generation. For they did not come to meet you with bread and water on your way when you came out of Egypt. And they hired Balaam, the son of Beor from Pethor and Aram Naharaim, to pronounce a curse on you. However, Yahweh your God would not listen to Balaam, but turned the curse into a blessing for you, because Yahweh your God loves you. Do not seek a treaty of friendship with them as long as you live. Okay, so the descendants of Moab and Ammon, even though God protected them, there was no love lost between them and the Israelites. The Israelites, and we'll see lots of conflict with the Moabites and Ammonites as time goes on. But even though God protected them, they were still a source of trouble to the Israelites, and they were despised. But the next verse, verse 7, do not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. Do not abhor an Egyptian, because you lived as an alien in his country. So we do see some problems with Edomites later on. But we see that the Edomites were accepted more as brothers than, say, the Moabites and the Ammonites were. Okay. Well, the next land they encounter would be what you see on your map on page 6, the land of Gilead. Okay. To whom did God give that land? Okay. He'd already given the land of Edom and Moab and Ammon to those descendants. What about the land of Gilead? Back to Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 24. Set out now and cross the Arnon Gorge. See, I've given into your hand Sihon the Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his country. Begin to take possession of it and engage him in battle. Okay? The king, in these times, and we'll see this as we continue to go through these stories, this wasn't one big nation. You know, like here we're used to the nation of the United States of America, and if somebody attacks one part, then that's attacking all of us. in these days, they had city-states, and each city was kind of its own country. Each city had a king, and they had fortified walls, and they had their own army. Maybe there were some townships around the city that that sought protection by that city and supported that city. But each city was kind of its own little country. The big city in Gilead was Heshbon, and the big king there was Sihon, and the little towns around there sought their protection from him. So God tells the Israelites here, okay, now you're going to go into the land of Gilead, and this is your land. Get ready to fight Sihon, the king of the Amorites. Okay, Amorites were the people in that area there. And I'm going to give this land to you. So God gave that southern land, we looked at that last week, that southern land of the Amorites to Israel. Okay? What about north of that? Okay? that land that they gave him was about midway, Gilead kind of went midway up the Jordan River. What about north of there? Deuteronomy chapter 3, verses 1 to 2. Says, next we turned and went up along the road toward Bashan. And Og, king of Bashan, with his whole army marched out to meet us in battle at Edrei. Yahweh said to me, do not be afraid of him, for I have handed him over to you with his whole army and his land. Do to him what you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon. Okay. So we see that God gave this land, the northern territory on the east side of the Jordan River, the land of Bashan, did you see there? That God gave over to the Israelites as well. And this all happened while Moses was still around. Now, through these victories, God accomplished a number of things. Okay, just through these two victories. Number one, it kind of gave them the first preparation in preparing for other battles that they would be having. But some bigger things happened here. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 25. In fact, God even says this before they experience these battles. He says, "This very day I will begin to put the terror and fear of you on all the nations under heaven. They will hear reports of you and will tremble and be in anguish because of you." So through these victories, people started hearing who these Israelites were. Not only started hearing about them, but started hearing about how powerful they were. And not powerful because of themselves, but powerful because of their God. And their God was bringing them victories. And people were afraid of them as a result of that. They will tremble and be in anguish. I will put terror and fear of you in their hearts. And so you see that started with these victories. Also in chapter 3, verse 7 to 8, as a result of these victories, it said, "All the livestock and the plunder from their cities we carried off for ourselves." So they gained a lot of wealth and riches, a lot of livestock, a lot of plunder from both the cities and the towns and all the territories on the east side of the Jordan River that were not part of Edom, Moab, and Ammon. On top of that, at that time, verse 8, "We took from these two kings of the Amorites the territory east of the Jordan, from the Arnon Gorge," okay, which you see the Arnon River is kind of midway on the eastern side of the Dead Sea, "up to Mount Hermon." Okay, and you see Mount Hermon way in the north, north of the Sea of Galilee. Large territory that they gained through these two battles. And that now was Israelite land. Okay, that was promised land, part of the promised land. So what happened to that land? What did Moses decide to do with this land? Chapter 3, starting at verse 12, "Of the land that we took over at that time, that's Moses speaking, I gave the Reubenites and the Gadites the territory north of Aroer by the Arnon Gorge, including half the hill country of Gilead together with its towns." So two of the tribes, Reuben and Gad, were given that land. And if you look at your map on page 6, you see that. Reuben was given right north of the Arnon Gorge, the river Arnon. And then north of them, you have Gad. And then he goes on to say, "The rest of Gilead and also all of Bashan, the kingdom of Og, I gave to the half-tribe of Manasseh." And so you see that on your map there. Now, the thing is Manasseh was a large tribe, and so they got two territories. Half of the tribe got this land here that you see in the north on the eastern side of the Jordan River. We'll see later on, after all the conquests under Joshua, you see the other half of the tribe of Manasseh get some land on the western side, and you see that on your map on page 6. So the Israelites now have some land, and that's even while Moses is around. Okay, this all happened while Moses was around. What about the rest of the tribes? What was God's plan to get land for them? And plus, Moses is 120 years old. Time to pass a torch, all of that. And we see that happen in the end of Deuteronomy. And then we move into the book of Joshua. We'll start there. Joshua 1. "After the death of Moses, the servant of Yahweh, Yahweh said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' aide, 'Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all these people, get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land that I'm about to give to them, the Israelites. I will give you every place where you set your foot, just as I've promised Moses. Your territory will extend from the desert to Lebanon, and from the great river, the Euphrates, all the Hittite country to the great sea," that's the Mediterranean Sea, "on the west. No one will be able to stand up against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you." So what was God's plan? Okay, we're here. My plan was not just to get here, but now I'm going to get the land for you. I'm going to give you this promised land. I'm going to raise up this leader. I'm going to be with Joshua, and I'm going to work through Joshua just as I was with and work through Moses. Okay? Everywhere you step will become your property. Okay? I'm going to give you victory all the days of Joshua's life. Okay? By the way, what does the name Joshua mean? It means the Lord saves. Yahweh saves. Joshua is the Hebrew form of that. The Greek form of that is the name Jesus. Okay, same name. But the people had been, in fact, the people at this time had all grown up under Moses. Okay, this second generation. And they only knew Moses, and Moses was their leader. Sure, Joshua was his vice president or second in command or helper, his aide. But how would they know that it was obvious to them that Moses walked with God and that God worked through Moses? How would they see God's hand through Joshua? How would God make sure that Israel looked to Joshua to make sure that they looked to him, that he as their leader as they entered the promised land? They needed a strong leader to go through these things. Joshua chapter 3. We'll kind of jump around a little bit. Verse 1. Early in the morning, Joshua and all the Israelites set out from Shittim and went to the Jordan where they camped before crossing over. And you can see that on your map. Okay, over there by Mount Pisgah. And they came over to the Jordan River. They stay there for 3 days, and then time to cross. And at that time, verse 7, Yahweh said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all Israel, so that they may know that I am with you as I was with Moses." Okay? So they're going to know because I'm going to do this, God says. I'm going to make sure everyone realizes that I am with and behind Joshua. So, verse 15. Now the Jordan River is at flood stage all during harvest. Yet, as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. Okay? So soon the priests were carrying the ark, and as soon as their feet touched the water stopped. And the water went away. The water stopped upstream, and it all flowed down. And verse 17, the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh stood firm on dry ground. This isn't muddy water or muddy sediment on the bottom of the river that's been flowing, but on dry ground until the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. This is a miracle. The parting of the Jordan River, the stopping of the Jordan River. And it's not just, you know, sometimes the Jordan River is not a lot to it, but this was during flood stage when all the snow in Mount Hermon and in the mountains up north was melting and flowing down, and the water stopped just as they stuck their feet in. Okay. What's also interesting, if you read on, and we won't do so on account of time, as soon as the priests step out of the Jordan River, the water starts. Right then. So what do the people get to see here? They get to see the same sort of miracle that they saw or that they had heard about had happened at the beginning of their Exodus wanderings when they came up to the Red Sea and Moses parted the Red Sea. Here we have Joshua parting the Jordan River. And so God exalted Joshua with this river parting just like he had done with Moses. Did this impact anyone besides the Israelites that Joshua was to lead? Well, chapter 5, verse 1 says, "Now when all the Amorite kings west of the Jordan and all the Canaanite kings along the coast heard how Yahweh had dried up the Jordan before the Israelites until we had crossed over, their hearts melted, and they no longer had the courage to face the Israelites." So not only were they already afraid from the stories that they heard about what the Israelites had done to Sihon and Og, to the eastern kings and eastern territories, but now it's clear their God is behind them. Only a God can make the water stop on the Jordan River. And when they heard that story, their hearts melted, and that made Israel even stronger to them. So the Israelites cross the Jordan River and come now into the Promised Land, or the heart of the Promised Land. There's a bunch of things that happen right after that, and we start seeing that in chapter 4. We'll look at those real quickly here. Verse 20, "And Joshua set up at Gilgal the 12 stones they had taken out of the Jordan. Okay, he had had leaders of each of the tribes go and grab a big stone. And he set them up as standing stones. Okay, that's where they would set them up on end. And the point of that being is that when someone came walking by and they saw these stones standing there, they went, okay, that didn't just happen. Those stones are like that for a reason. So it serves as some kind of a memorial for to cause someone to ask, okay, why are those stones like that? And going on, verse 21, he said to the Israelites, in the future when your descendants ask their fathers, what do these stones mean? Well, then tell them, Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For Yahweh your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed over. Yahweh your God did to the Jordan just what he had done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us until we had crossed over. He did this so that all the people of the earth might know that the hand of Yahweh is powerful, and so that you might always fear Yahweh your God. So he set up these standing stones as a memorial of God's power and God's love for Israel, so that it would be a reminder for future generations and for other peoples as well. Okay? And then, the next few verses we have in chapter 5, we'll summarize in verse 3. Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the Israelites at Gibeah Haaroth. So the men had not been circumcised while they were in the desert. But now that they had come into the promised land, the calling to be a separate, cut-off people was there before them. And so Joshua did that. And everybody was circumcised to remind them that they were to be a separate, cut-off people, separated from other people for God. Here they're going into someone else's land, and that needs to be a reminder to them not to mix with those people, but that they're to be God's people. Okay? And then verse 10. On the evening of the 14th day of the month, and we read this already, while camped at Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, the Israelites celebrated the Passover. Okay? So they celebrated the Passover. We've already seen that. And then the next verses. The day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened bread and roasted grain. The manna stopped the day after they ate this food from the land. There was no longer any manna for the Israelites, but that year they ate of the produce of Canaan. Okay? God had provided all these years this manna, this what is it stuff, the stuff that we don't know what it is, we haven't seen it since. And it was there for them every day, except on the Sabbath, but the day before was a double share, until they came into the promised land. And the promised land was a land flowing with milk and honey, with all the best. And there God provided for them with the fruit of the land. Once they started eating of the fruit of the land, 40 years later, the manna stops and they eat the produce of the land. And the other thing, verse 15. Actually, I'm going to start back on verse 13. It says, when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, are you for us or for our enemies? Neither, he replied, but as commander of the army of Yahweh, I have now come. Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, what message does my Lord have for his servant? The commander of Yahweh's army replied, take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy. And Joshua did so. So, you know, if the memorial of standing stones wasn't enough, if the circumcision ceremony wasn't enough, if the Passover wasn't enough, if the fact that manna stopped coming and they now ate of the produce of the land wasn't enough, God sent his angel to point out to Joshua, you're here. This is the Holy Land. This is the promised land. This is the land that God had prepared for his people, that had promised to his people. And now I'm about to give it to you. And then we see, they go on in. The first city-state that they come to on the other side of the Jordan River ends up being a very heavily fortified, very big, powerful city. City of Jericho. Joshua chapter 6. Now in Joshua chapter 6 we see that Jericho was tightly shut up because of the Israelites. No one went out and no one came in. Why? Because they were afraid of the Israelites. God had put the fear and terror in their hearts about these people and the stories that they heard about them drying up the Jordan River, all of that. Then verse 2, then Yahweh said to Joshua, see, I've delivered Jericho into your hands, along with its king and its fighting men. Well, Joshua looks, he's got this big city there, all fortified, huge. You know, these walls are 10 or 12 feet thick. Very, very heavily fortified, but yet God says, I've given it to you. Okay? Well, how? How can they take this? These are a bunch of, they're not well-trained soldiers. They don't have chariots. They don't have tanks and bombs and all that. You know, how would they break into this city? The city is tightly shut up. Well, God takes care of that. Chapter 6, verses 3 to 5. March around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times with the priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound a long blast on the trumpets, have all the people give a loud shout, and then the wall of the city will collapse, and the people will go up, every man straight in. There's no way for these 12-inch thick walls to fall down, but yet God would make it happen. All they had to do is march around the city once every day for 6 days, and then on the 7th day, 7 times, and they give a big shout, and the walls would come tumbling down. And they did. Okay? God intervened and made this happen and gave them this victory. So how did they respond to God with this first victory on the west side of the Jordan River? Verse 20. When the trumpet sounded, the people shouted, and at the sound of the trumpet, when the people gave a loud shout, the wall collapsed. So every man charged straight in, and they took the city. They devoted the city to Yahweh and destroyed with the sword every living thing in it, men, women, young and old, cattle, sheep, donkeys. Okay? So they devoted everything to God. The next couple verses say, except for Rahab and her family who had protected the spies. They did protect her as they had promised. In verse 24, then they burned the whole city and everything in it, but they put the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron in the treasury of Yahweh's house. Just as God had instructed them to do. So they destroyed everything. They devoted everything to God, which meant that they killed everything and they took the valuables and put them in God's house. The interesting word there, haram, is the Hebrew word for devoted. Okay, it's the same word that's translated as completely destroyed in Joshua chapter 2, verse 10. And you see it translated both ways throughout the Bible. Okay, so when it says that it was devoted to God, that means it was sacrificed, totally destroyed for God and given to God. Okay, now with this big town, this is located in a good location, with Jericho destroyed and gutted, did they intend then to rebuild a city for themselves there? Verse 26, at that time Joshua pronounced this solemn oath, cursed before Yahweh is the man who undertakes to rebuild this city Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn son will he lay its foundations, at the cost of his youngest will he set up its gates. So you see, there was no desire for them to rebuild a city there. In fact, this whole city had been devoted to God, had been destroyed and sacrificed to God. For someone to rebuild it is taking it back from God. So this is to be forever a location, not just a city and the people there, but the location would be devoted to God. And Joshua put this curse that said, if anyone ever tries to build on this, he's going to do so at the cost of his firstborn son and his lastborn son. Well, you know what? That happened. 1 Kings chapter 16, and we see this is during the time of Ahab. Ahab is the most evil king of all of Israel. And we'll look at this in a couple of months when we get into the kings. But during his time, we see that a guy named Hiel in 1 Kings 16, verse 34. In Ahab's time, Hiel of Bethel rebuilt Jericho. Okay, just what Joshua had proclaimed that no one should ever do. It goes on to say, he laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn son, Abiram. And he set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son, Segub, in accordance with the word of Yahweh spoken by Joshua, the son of Nun. So that curse that Joshua had given many years earlier was fulfilled when this guy tried to rebuild and rebuilt Jericho, and he was cursed, as Joshua had said. So that's Jericho. Well, let's move on. What's the next place they come to? Well, if you look at your map, page 6, what's the next? If you keep kind of moving west, you get to this town called Ai, or this city called Ai. And we see that in chapter 7. Now, Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Bethaven, to the east of Bethel, and told them, go up and spy out the region. So the men went up and spied out Ai. When they returned to Joshua, they said, you know, not all the people have to go up against Ai. Just send 2,000 or 3,000 men to take it. Don't worry all the people, for only a few men are there. So they went up and they saw Ai and said, oh, it's not a big deal. We got God on our side. Just a few people will take care of it. The name Ai means ruin, the ruin. Okay, well, we'll see. It becomes a ruin. It's east of Bethel. Bethel is a place where we have seen Abraham worship. We've seen Jacob worship there. The spies look at it and say, this is an easy win. No big deal. So how does the battle go? Verse 4. So about 3,000 men went up, but they were routed by the men of Ai, who killed about 36 of them. They chased the Israelites from the city gate as far as the stone quarries and struck them down on the slopes. At this, the hearts of the people melted and became like water. They've been defeated. This was a no big deal. We can take these people easily. So let's just go and let's do it. So they go, and they're defeated. Well, there's two problems here. Number one is they're saying, oh, we can do it. Okay, they're not seeing they have to depend on God and let God tell them what to do. They're taking it upon themselves. But there's a bigger problem here, too. And we find out what this problem is. If we go on, verse 6. Then Joshua tore his clothes and fell face down to the ground before the ark of Yahweh, remaining there until evening. The elders of Israel did the same and sprinkled dust on their heads. And then we'll skip to verse 10. Yahweh said to Joshua, stand up. What are you doing down on your face? Israel has sinned. They violated my covenant, which I commanded them to keep. They've taken some of the devoted things. They've stolen. They've lied. They've put them with their own possessions. Okay? So what was the real root cause of their loss at Ai? God was not with them because they were not with God. Somebody had not kept God's covenant. And God's covenant was for them to make Jericho a completely devoted place, meaning that everything, every life was destroyed, the city was destroyed, anything of any value was given to God, was put in the Lord's treasury. But something had happened. And so then they go, okay, well, gosh, there's millions of people here. How do we find out who this is? So how do they find out? Verse 14. In the morning, this is God continues speaking here. In the morning, present yourself tribe by tribe. The tribe that Yahweh takes will come forward, clan by clan. The clan that Yahweh takes will come forward, family by family. And the family that Yahweh takes will come forward, man by man. Okay? So God would point out by going, okay, we'll go tribe by tribe, then clan by clan, then family by family, then person by person kind of thing until it's identified. And God would identify, and they threw lots for God to tell them who was the offender. Then going on verse 19, the lot comes on this guy named Achan, okay, A-C-H-A-N. Sometimes also in another place he's referred to as Achar, A-C-H-A-R, which is Hebrew for trouble. Okay, this guy brought trouble on them. So, verse 19, then Joshua said to Achan, my son, give glory to Yahweh, the God of Israel, and give him the praise. Your NIV note down there says, that could also be translated, instead of, and give him praise, and confess to him. Okay, tell me what you've done. Do not hide it from me. Achan replied, it's true. I have sinned against Yahweh, the God of Israel. This is what I've done. When I saw in the plunder a beautiful robe from Babylonia, 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and I took them. They're hidden in the ground inside my tent with the silver underneath. Achan had seen some valuable stuff, and he wanted to keep it for himself and did not let it be devoted to God as God had commanded. When we talked about the wanderings in the wilderness, we saw many ways that God led his people to trust him, and one of the ways was through rigid discipline. We see rigid discipline being used here. What kind of rigid discipline does God have in store for cleansing Israel from the sin of Achan? Verse 15, God says, "He who is caught with the devoted things shall be destroyed by fire, along with all that belongs to him. He has violated the covenant of Yahweh and has done a disgraceful thing in Israel." In verse 25, Joshua said to Achan, "Why have you brought this trouble on us? Yahweh will bring trouble on you today." Then all Israel stoned him, and after they'd stoned the rest, they burned them. Over Achan they heaped up a large pile of rocks, which remains to this day. Then Yahweh turned from his fierce anger. Therefore, that place has been called the Valley of Achor ever since, the Valley of Trouble ever since. Okay. I had skipped verse 24. It said that they had grabbed his sons and daughters, cattle, donkeys, sheep, all of that. So Achan refused to honor God's covenant of Jericho being devoted to God. So instead then, Achan and his family and all that belonged to him became devoted to God. And they were all sacrificed. They were all killed and destroyed. And that purged and cleansed the sin from Israel. What's the lesson to Israel here? One bad apple does spoil the whole bunch. A little bit of leaven does spoil the lump. Okay, and so keep the sin from away from the community. Purge the evil ones. It's a very strong lesson here to the Israelites. All right, so they've purged this problem, and now God's back on their side to go with defeat Ai. So what plan does God give Joshua for defeating Ai with his help? Starting in verse 3 of chapter 8. "So Joshua and the whole army moved out to attack Ai. He chose 30,000 men, 30,000 of his best fighting men, and sent them out at night with these orders. Listen carefully. You're to set an ambush from behind the city. Don't go very far from it. All of you are on the alert. I and all those with me will advance on the city, and when the men come out against us, as they did before, we will flee from them. They'll pursue us until we have lured them away from the city, for they'll say, 'Ah, they're running away from us,' as they did before. So when we flee from them, you are to rise up from your ambush and take the city. Yahweh your God will give it into your hand. When you've taken the city, set it on fire. Do what Yahweh has commanded. See to it. You have my orders." Okay. So he sent out an ambush party to go from behind the city. Then the main army would go and draw the city out, draw the soldiers out. Okay, we see how this works. We kind of go back to about verse 10 or 11. It says, "Early the next morning, Joshua and his men got up, and the entire force that was with them marched up and approached the city and arrived in front of it and set up camp." They had soldiers take their positions. And then verse 14, "When the king of Ai saw this, he and all the men of the city hurried out early in the morning to meet Israel in battle at a certain place overlooking the Arabah. But he did not know that an ambush had been set against him in the city, or behind the city. Joshua and Israel let themselves be driven back before them as they fled towards the desert. And all the men of Ai were called to pursue them, and they pursued Joshua and were lured away from the city. Not a man remained in Ai or Bethel," Bethel is right next door, "who did not go after Israel. They left the city open and went in pursuit of Israel. Then Yahweh said to Joshua, 'Okay, hold out towards Ai the javelin that's in your hand, for into your hand I will deliver the city.' So Joshua held out his javelin towards Ai. As soon as he did this, the men in the ambush rose quickly from their position and rushed forward. They entered the city and captured it and quickly set it on fire. The men of Ai looked back and saw the smoke of the city rising against the sky. But they had no chance to escape in any direction, for the Israelites who had been fleeing toward the desert had turned back against their pursuers. For when Joshua and all of Israel saw that the ambush had taken the city and that the smoke was coming up from the city, they turned around and attacked the men of Ai. The men of the ambush also came out of the city against them, so that they were caught in the middle with Israelites on both sides. Israel cut them down, leaving them neither survivors nor fugitives. But they took the king of Ai alive and brought him to Joshua." So you see this ambush and how it worked. And could you imagine being one of the men of Ai going out and then looking back and seeing that your city's on fire and your family's just been, you can imagine what might have just happened. Your family's killed. Your house is being destroyed. You just immediately lose all hope, and then you look and you see that the soldiers that you were chasing are now chasing you, and then you look behind you and there's soldiers coming out the other way, and so they are just utterly destroyed. And so God gives a great victory to the Israelites here. Now we saw at Jericho that Jericho was to be devoted to the Lord, completely destroyed and everything given to God. What about Ai? We'll go back to verse 2. God speaking says, you shall do to Ai and its king as you did to Jericho and its king, except that you may carry off their plunder and livestock for yourselves. It's a sudden ambush behind the city. So they were to kill all people, just as they had done in Jericho, but the valuables, the livestock, the plunder could be used to enrich in Israel. What did Joshua do in response to God's gift of victory here? Verse 30. Then Joshua built on Mount Ebal. Now you can see it. Mount Ebal is not far from Mount Gerizim that you see on your map there. He built on Mount Ebal an altar to Yahweh, the God of Israel, as Moses, the servant of Yahweh, had commanded the Israelites. Okay, he built it according to what's written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of uncut stones on which no iron tool has been used. On it they offered to Yahweh burnt offerings and sacrificed fellowship offerings. There in the presence of the Israelites, Joshua copied on stones the law of Moses which he had written. Okay, and all the people were there watching this. Half of the people were in front of Mount Gerizim, the other half in front of Mount Ebal. And then afterward, Joshua read all the words of the law, the blessings and the curses, just as it is written in the book of the law. Okay? There's not a word of all that Moses had commanded that Joshua did not read to the whole assembly of Israel. So, after these victories, Joshua renews God's covenant on Mount Ebal. He builds this altar, does sacrifices, reads God's word, and recommits, sets up these big stones and writes the God's commands on them. All of this, Moses had given instructions to do this in Deuteronomy chapter 27. You can look back at that on your own, Deuteronomy 27. Joshua fulfills that at this time here. Well, let's move on then. There's a town not far by called Gibeon, actually a pretty good-sized city, a large, powerful city. According to Joshua 10, verse 2, it says, Gibeon was an important city, like one of the royal cities. It was larger than Ai, and its men were good fighters. Okay, but although its men were good fighters, they had heard about these Israelites. They, like the other Canaanites and Hivites and Hittites and Etcetites, had heard about what the God of the Israelites had done for them, and were afraid. And so what did they do? How did they respond to this Israelite threat? Chapter 9, starting at verse 3. However, when the people of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they resorted to a ruse. They went as a delegation whose donkeys were loaded with worn-out sacks and old wineskins cracked and mended. The men put worn and patched sandals on their feet and wore old clothes. All the bread of their food supply was dry and moldy. And then they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal and said to him and the men of Israel, "We've come from a distant country. Make a treaty with us." Okay? So they decide they want to make a treaty. They realize that they're kind of one of the next ones in line of being destroyed by this mass of people coming in with their God. So it's either be destroyed or let's make a treaty and become servants to this people and make a treaty with them. But we can't just go to them because this land is given to them and they're going to lay claim to it. So if we identify ourselves, if we try to seek peace, we're not going to get peace unless they think that we're from far away. So they put this ruse to look like distant travelers to trick Israel into making a treaty with them. How does Israel respond to this request for a treaty? Verse 7. The men of Israel said to the Hivites, "But perhaps you live near us. How then could we make a treaty with you?" Okay, so they obviously had the right question here. Afraid to go into a treaty because they were neighbors. Why were they afraid to do so? Well, if you look back at Numbers 33, verse 51, This is God speaking to Moses. It says, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into Canaan, drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you. Destroy all their carved images and their cast idols and demolish their high places. Take possession of the land and settle in it, for I've given you the land to possess." Okay? So God had commanded them to go take that land and not to leave any of the people, to destroy all the people, drive out all the inhabitants of the land. What would happen if they didn't, if they left some of the people there? Verse 55. "But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land, those you allow to remain will become barbs in your eyes and thorns in your side. They will give you trouble in the land where you are to live. And then I will do to you what I plan to do to them." Okay? So they had a very strong warning against leaving anyone. They were called to go and wipe the place clean and take this land that God was giving to them. Okay? If they left anyone, then that was against God's command, and God warned them that they would be treated as He's having them treat them. So it was very important that they would not make a treaty with someone who they were supposed to wipe out. So what did Joshua and the leaders decide to do? Verse 14. "The men of Israel sampled the provisions of the Gibeonites," you know, all this moldy bread and dry wineskins and all that, "but they did not inquire of Yahweh. Joshua made a treaty of peace with them to let them live, and the leaders of the assembly ratified it by oath." So how did they respond? Well, then 3 days after they made the treaty with the Gibeonites, the Israelites heard that they were neighbors living near them. So what did they do? They decided to make a treaty. It looks right. Looks fine. It looks like these guys are from way out of town. Their story sounds correct. So let's make a treaty with them. And then they find out, nope, these are neighbors. These are people that God wanted us to wipe out. What was their big problem? They did not look to God for guidance. They did not ask God. They did not inquire of the Lord. Okay? And as a result, they made this big mistake. So what did Israel do with the Gibeonites after learning about this trick? Starting in the second half of verse 18, "The whole assembly grumbled against the leaders. But all the leaders answered, 'We've given them our oath by Yahweh, the God of Israel. We cannot touch them now.'" Okay? Once they've made their oath and they've made their promise to Yahweh, they can't break a promise to Yahweh. That would be even worse than what they've already done. So this is what we'll do to them. We'll let them live so that the wrath will not fall on us for breaking the oath that we swore to them. But they continued, "Let them live, but let them be woodcutters and water carriers for the entire community." So the leader's promise to them was kept. So they were turned into slaves. They were turned into woodcutters and water carriers and just doing whatever tasks that the community needed them to do. Okay, and in fact, it goes on to say that in verse 27, that's what they are to this day. So when this book was written, the Gibeonites were still serving as servants to the Israelites here. All right, so a hard lesson that they learned about the importance of inquiring of the Lord. Okay, they made a big mistake here. Well, all right, let's go on. There are a bunch of other city-states here. And we see that there's five major kings in the south here. And when they hear about what Gibeon did, what do? Verse 5 of chapter 10. "The five kings of the Amorites, the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon, joined forces. They moved up with all their troops and took up positions against Gibeon and attacked them." Why in verse 4 it says, "Because it has made peace with Joshua and the Israelites." So they saw these guys as traitors, and they said, okay, we got to get rid of Gibeon. And so they go, and these five kings attack Gibeon for allying with Israel. Big mistake. Why? Verse 7. "So Joshua marched up from Gilgal with his entire army, including all the best fighting men. Yahweh said to Joshua, 'Do not be afraid of them. I've given them into your hand. Not one of them will be able to withstand you.' After an all-night march from Gilgal, Joshua took them by surprise. Yahweh threw them into confusion before Israel, who defeated them in a great victory at Gibeon. Israel pursued them along the road going up to Beth Horon and cut them down all the way to Azekah and Makkedah. So, by them attacking Gibeon, well, the Gibeons are now servants to the Israelites, and so the Israelites then go to protect Gibeon. But God's hand is here, and in fact, this is an opportunity that God uses then to give the Israelites victory over all these major kings of the south. So you see this big victory, and you see God gets involved in this too. You know, we already saw here that in verse 10 that Yahweh threw him into confusion. You know, you've got these five different armies, and they get confused on who's who and probably start fighting and killing each other. So there's a big confusion there. Nobody's really in charge, or at least very well. But God also gets involved. Verse 11, as they fled before Israel on the road down from Beth Horon to Azekah, Yahweh hurled large hailstones down on them from the sky, and more of them died from the hailstones than were killed by the swords of the Israelites. So, truly a victory from God, right? On top of that, on that day, Yahweh gave the Amorites over to Israel. Joshua said to Yahweh in the presence of Israel, O sun, stand still over Gibeon. O moon, over the valley of Ajalon. So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped till the nation avenged itself on its enemies, as is written in the book of Jashar. The sun stopped in the middle of the day and delayed going down about a full day. So God held back time. God gave time to the Israelites to finish mopping up these Canaanites that they were fighting against. Okay, and God killed most of them with hailstones, but then allowed the Israelites plenty of time to finish the job. And that's after they had marched all night. So he gave them strength, even though they hadn't had any sleep for a long time and had been marching a long time. What happened as a result of the cleanup attacks on the cities that these armies protected? You know, not only did they clean up the armies, but then they went around all the cities and captured them and destroyed them. Verse 40. So Joshua subdued the whole region, including the hill country, the Negev, the western foothills and the mountain slopes, together with all their kings. He left no survivors. He totally destroyed all who breathed, just as Yahweh, the God of Israel, had commanded. Joshua subdued them from Kadesh Barnea to Gaza and from the whole region of Goshen to Gibeon. Okay, all these kings and their lands Joshua conquered in one campaign because Yahweh, the God of Israel, fought for Israel. Okay, so through this one campaign, because God was involved, Israel gained all this territory from down in the Negev that you see at the southern part of your map here on page 6, all there through, well, you see the towns, Beersheba, Debir, Hebron, Jerusalem, Lachish, all that area. Not the coastline, okay, but the mountains and the foothills, the hill country of Judah there, up to Ai and Bethel. So that whole southern part, the western side of the Dead Sea, God gave to the Israelites at this time. Okay, the lines here talk about from Kadesh Barnea to Gaza, from Gibeon to Goshen. Now this is Goshen in the Negev. There's another Goshen. The Goshen that you're familiar with is the one in Egypt where they lived for 400 years. There's an area on the eastern part of the Negev that they also called Goshen there. That's what that's referred to. All right, so now they've got this land on the east side of the Jordan. They've got the land to the west of the Jordan, at least south of Ai and Bethel. What about north of there? What did the northern kings, the kings of the cities up north, what did they think about what was going on? What did they do in response? Chapter 11, starting at verse 4. They came out with all their troops and a large number of horses and chariots, a huge army, as numerous as sand on the seashore. Okay? And this is not only a big army, but very well equipped. You're talking horses and chariots. That's like tanks and those kind of things in today's army. All these kings joined forces and made camp together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. So they came together in force. All these kings led by Jabin, who we see in verse 1, king of Hazor. He kind of coordinated this of all these northern kings. So what happened there? Verse 6, Yahweh said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them, because by this time tomorrow, I will hand all of them over to Israel, slain." They'll be dead. "You are to hamstring their horses and burn their chariots." Okay? And we never see the Israelites using chariots and that kind of weaponry, the advanced weaponry like that, until Solomon's time. We see some chariots then. So these were not to be people of war. They're warring now because they're taking the land that God's promised them, but it's really God fighting for them. But these implements of war were not things that were supposed to be part of who they were. So they were to destroy those. Verse 7, "So Joshua and his whole army came against them suddenly at the waters of Merom and attacked them. And Yahweh gave them into the hand of Israel. They defeated them and pursued them all the way to Greater Sidon, to Misrephoth Maim, and to the valley of Mizpah on the east, until no survivors was left." So God gave the coalition forces over to Israel. Okay, although it was a very powerful and mighty and large army, God gave victory to the Israelites. And what happened as a result? They then go through the northern area, cleaning up the area. And as a result, verse 12, "Joshua took all these royal cities and their kings and put them to the sword. He totally destroyed them as Moses, the servant of Yahweh, had commanded. Yet Israel did not burn any of the cities built on their mounds except for Hazor, which Joshua burned. The Israelites carried off for themselves all the plunder and livestock of these cities, but all the people they put to the sword until they completely destroyed them, not sparing anyone that breathed." Okay? So he went and cleaned the area, wiped the northern region clean, picked up that area. It says they didn't destroy all the cities, except for Hazor. And if you look at the archaeology that when they've excavated Hazor, they found confirmation of the destruction and the burning that's mentioned there in verse 11. Hazor was a huge city. And again, Hazor was the city where Jabin, the king of Hazor, coordinated this coalition to go and attack the Israelites. Were there any other specific towns that the Israelites targeted for attack? Joshua 11, verse 21. "At that time, Joshua went and destroyed the Anakites from the hill country, from Hebron, Debir, and Anab, from all the hill country of Judah, and from all the hill country of Israel. Joshua totally destroyed them and their towns. No Anakites were left in Israelite territory. Only in Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod did any survive," which you see are way over on the Mediterranean Sea coast in the land of the Philistines. So all the Anakites, who were the Anakites? Those were the giants. If you look back in Numbers 13, those were the giants that scared the spies. That they said, "Oh, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Nephilim were there, and they scared us. There's no way we can defeat them." Well, this is just one other battle for Joshua, and he goes and he takes care of them and destroys the Anakites, eliminates them from the territory. All right, what territory then did Joshua and the Israelites have? Verse 16, chapter 11. "So Joshua took this entire land, the hill country, all the Negev, the whole region of Goshen," that's the eastern part of the Negev, "the western foothills, the Arabah." The Arabah is the big valley that the Jordan River goes through, the big valley that goes from the Sea of Galilee down through the Dead Sea and even actually goes further south. Big rift there. "The Arabah and the mountains of Israel with their foothills, from Mount Halak, which rises towards Seir, to Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon below Mount Hermon. He captured all their kings and struck them down, putting them to death." So really, all this land that we see here from the Negev on up, the southern Negev on up to Mount Hermon that you see way up in the north, all that land now was part of Israel. You know, we know a few parts weren't, like you see on the eastern side, Edom and Moab and Ammon, we know God protected. They didn't take the Philistine land. There's some land here that that still hasn't been taken. You kind of see that in chapter 13. It says, "When Joshua was old and well advanced in years, Yahweh said to him, 'You're very old, and there's still very large areas of land to be taken over.' And he goes on and says, all the regions of the Philistines and the Geshurites, and talks about all this land and these people who are still there, that is part of the land that God wants to give to the Israelites, but the Israelites need to take it. But they can't count on Joshua. Joshua's getting very old at this time, and there's still more to be done. The land north of Mount Hermon is also mentioned in there. Okay, so, but at least to this time, we do have the main part of the promised land that Joshua's been able to capture while he was around. Now we go through a lot of really exciting chapters, and we'll let you read those on your own. Chapters 13 through 21, some of the things that you see there. Chapter 13, well, you can summarize in verse 8. The other half of Manasseh, the Reubenites and Gadites, received their inheritance that Moses had given them east of the Jordan, as he, the servant of the Lord, had assigned to them. So, chapter 13 talks about the land and gives the territory and geographies and the cities of the land of Reuben, land of Gad, and the land of Manasseh. So the territories that were assigned there. Chapters 14 through 19, you see the same sort of thing. You see the lands west of the Jordan River are assigned to the other 9.5 tribes, the other 9 tribes plus the other half tribe of Manasseh. And so if you look through those chapters, you'll see the borders and the cities and all that defined for Judah, for Benjamin, for Dan, for the half tribe of Manasseh, for Ephraim, Issachar, Zebulun, Asher, okay, Simeon, all of that is defined in those chapters. Okay? So now that they've had these conquests, Joshua's getting old, that's the next thing that he's got to take care of, is divvying up the land. You also have then in Joshua chapter 20, cities of refuge. We'll start at verse 1. Then Yahweh said to Joshua, tell the Israelites to designate the cities of refuge as I instructed you through Moses, so that anyone who kills a person accidentally and unintentionally may flee there and find protection from the avenger of blood. Okay, so if someone accidentally kills somebody, there would be these cities of refuge that he can go to, and he could plead his case there, and if the people there, the leaders of that city believe that, yes, this was an accident, then they'll protect him until the guy could have an honest trial, protect him from some avenger trying to take revenge for the murder that, for the death that he had taken. Then also in chapter 21, we see Levite towns. And as Yahweh had commanded, verse 3, Israelites gave the Levites the following towns and pasture lands out of their own inheritance. There was no tribal land for the tribe of Levi. They were to be the priests. They were to support the priests. And instead of having their own territory, they were to live throughout the rest of the people. And so in each tribe, towns were given to the Levites, cities were given to the Levites for them to live and live among them. And that's defined in Joshua chapter 21. Okay, moving on to chapter 22, we then see that now that all the major victories have been completed, even though there are still little pockets to be taken care of, the big job was basically done, so Joshua allows something. We see Joshua summoned the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and said to him, you've done all that Moses, the servant of Yahweh, commanded, and you've obeyed me in everything that I commanded. And moving on to verse 6, so Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their homes. So if you remember, when Reuben and Gad and half of the tribe of Manasseh said, you know, we've got a lot of livestock, this land on the eastern side of the Jordan River is just perfect for us, let us have this land, Moses said, well, okay, but you've got to go into battle with your brothers and you cannot go back to your land. You can leave your families there, but you cannot go back and settle until your other brothers have rest from their battles. And they said, sure, that's what we'll do. And sure enough, that's what they did. Joshua commends them for their faithfulness in doing that and said, okay, your job's done. You can go home now. You can go to your territories. So they do. They go back east to go across the Jordan River. On their way home, though, they do something. Verse 10. When they came to Geliloth, near the Jordan in the land of Canaan, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an imposing altar there by the Jordan. So they build this altar on their way home there by the Jordan River. How did the other Israelites respond when they heard about this, and why? Verse 11. When the Israelites heard that they had built the altar on the border of Canaan at Geliloth near the Jordan on the Israelite side, the whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war against them. Why would they do that? Verse 16, the whole assembly of Yahweh says, how can you break faith with the God of Israel like this? How could you turn away from Yahweh and build yourselves an altar in rebellion against Him now? Verse 19, if the land you possess is defiled, come over to Yahweh's land where Yahweh's tabernacle stands and share the land with us. But do not rebel against Yahweh or against us by building an altar for yourselves other than the altar of Yahweh our God. So they, you know, one of the things that the Israelites were commanded to do when they came into this territory is not only destroy the people and wipe it clean, but destroy all their pagan altars and high places where they built shrines and temples and destroy all of that because there is no God other than Yahweh. Well, the Israelites hear about these eastern tribes building this altar and they're going, what are they doing? They're picking a God for themselves. Not only are they concerned about the faithfulness, but verse 20 is interesting. When Achan the son of Zerah acted unfaithfully regarding the devoted things, did not wrath come upon the whole community of Israel? He's not the only one who died for his sin. So they remember that lesson of Achan, that when one person sins, when one person creates this big problem in Israel, all of Israel suffers. And here, these 2.5 tribes look like they're worshiping another god or making an altar to another god. All of Israel will suffer for that. So Israel decides we've got to purge this. So they're ready to go to fight and battle against their brothers who had fought with them all these years or all this time in the to capture the promised land. So is that the intention of the altar? What was the intention of the altar? Verse 26. We can look starting at verse 26, but let's kind of back up to verse 21. Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh replied to the heads of the clans of Israel. God knows, okay? Yahweh knows, and let Israel know. If this has been in rebellion or in disobedience to Yahweh, well, then don't spare us this day. If we built our own altar to turn away from Yahweh and to offer burnt offerings and grain offerings or to sacrifice fellowship offerings on it, well, then may Yahweh Himself call us to account. But no, we didn't do it for that reason. We did it for fear that someday your descendants might say to ours, what do you have to do with Yahweh, the God of Israel? Yahweh has made the Jordan a boundary between us and you, you Reubenites and Gadites. You have no share in Yahweh. So your descendants might cause ours to stop fearing Yahweh. So this is why we said, let's get ready and build an altar, but not for burnt offerings or sacrifices. On the contrary, it's to be a witness between us and you and the generations that follow, that we will worship Yahweh at His sanctuary with our burnt offerings, sacrifices, and fellowship offerings. Then in the future, your descendants will not be able to say to ours, you have no share in Yahweh. Okay? So they're concerned, as they go across the Jordan River, that they're kind of a remote group, and they can very easily see that in the future years, their descendants may not be accepted by the other Israelite descendants as being regular Israelites and as being people of God. And so they set up this altar to be a reminder to both parties that they are part of the same family and part of the same covenant family, part of the family of God. Okay? There was no desire or intent to sacrifice or put offerings on that altar. They would still go back to the altar that all of Israel shared. That was the intent. So did that satisfy the Israelites? Verse 31. Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, said to Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, today we know that Yahweh is with us because you have not acted unfaithfully towards Yahweh in this matter. Now you have rescued the Israelites from Yahweh's hands. So they say, yes, okay. What you did is good. We misinterpreted it. And they were thrilled that Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh were still faithful. But they had been prepared to wipe them out. They had been prepared to go to war against them because faithfulness was so important. Now, Joshua 23, Joshua is up in years, and we see in chapter 24, verse 29, that Joshua dies at the age of 110, and Joshua knows he's nearing that time, and so he gives some parting words in chapter 23 and chapter 24. chapter 23, did he feel that he had completed the conquest before he died? Starting at verse 1. After a long time had passed and Yahweh had given Israel rest from their enemies around them, Joshua by then was old and well advanced in years. He summoned all of Israel, their elders, leaders, judges, and officials, and said to him, I'm old and well advanced in years. You yourselves have seen everything that Yahweh your God has done to all these nations for your sake. It was Yahweh your God who fought for you. Remember how I allotted as an inheritance for your tribes all the land of the nations that remain, the nations that I conquered between the Jordan and the Great Sea in the west. Yahweh your God himself will drive them out of your way. He will push them out before you, and you will take possession of their land as Yahweh your God has promised you. Okay, so he reminds them there's still some people here that need to be wiped clean, and God will give you those victories, just as he gave you those victories while I've been around. Okay, then he gives them some instructions and warnings. Verse 6, be very strong, be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, without turning aside to the right or to the left. Do not associate with these nations that remain among you. Do not invoke the names of their gods or swear by them. You must not serve them or bow down to them, but you're to hold fast to Yahweh your God as you have until now. And then verse 12, but if you turn away, well, verse 11, so be very careful to love Yahweh your God, but if you turn away and ally yourselves with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, and if you intermarry with them and associate with them, then you may be sure that Yahweh your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. Instead, they will become snares and traps for you, whips on your backs, thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which Yahweh your God has given you. Okay? So make sure that you remain separate. I'm going to go. Moses is gone. I'm going to go. But you need to remain faithful, even though we're not here. Okay? Obey God. Read the words that he's given you. Obey them. Listen to them. Keep yourself separate. You're called to be a separate, circumcised, cut-off people. Stay separate. Do not intermix with the people that are still around here. In fact, drive them out like God has commanded. Do not intermarry with them. Do not look to their gods or worship their gods or even consider their gods. Okay? If you do any of those things, then God will not drive them out before you. He will leave them there to become pains in the rear for you, to become thorns in your eyes and whips on your backs, to be a pain and a temptation for you. Okay? So clean them out now and keep separate from them always. Be a separate people. And he kind of culminates this in the next verses. These are key verses here. Chapter 24, verses 14 and 15. Now, fear Yahweh and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt and serve Yahweh. But if serving Yahweh seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day who you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. We will serve Yahweh. Okay? So choose today who you will serve. I'm about to go the way of the world, he says back in chapter 23, verse 14. My time here is not long, so I'm going to be going. But you need to decide for yourself who you're going to serve. You've seen what Yahweh has done for you. You've seen that he's your God. Decide today. Is Yahweh your God? Or are you going to serve the gods of the ancestors of Abraham that they served beyond the river? You're going to serve the gods of the Egyptians? You're going to serve the gods of the Amorites, the people who we've conquered? For me and my household, we're going to serve Yahweh. So what do they decide? What choice do they make? Verse 24. And the people said to Joshua, we will serve Yahweh our God and obey him. So on that day, Joshua made a covenant for the people, and there at Shechem, he drew up for them decrees and laws. Okay, so they decided we will serve and obey Yahweh. And then the covenant was there renewed at Shechem. How faithful did the Israelites remain? Verse 29 and 31. After these things, Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of Yahweh, died at the age of 110. And Israel served Yahweh throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had experienced everything that Yahweh had done for Israel. So we see that the people remained faithful in that generation. While Joshua was around, while the people who worked, the elders who had worked with Joshua and who had experienced God's mighty hand throughout all these times, while they were around, the people remained faithful. There obviously sounds like there's a but to that. That but we'll look at next week when we go further into the next book, the book of Judges. Let's close with prayer. God our Father, we thank you for showing your mighty hand in so many ways, with big and powerful ways that that you've shown at the Exodus, in getting the Israelites out of Egypt, or when the Israelites wandered in the wilderness, your hand of provision and taking care of them in a place where they couldn't live. But then in giving them the promised land and in giving them victories over people that there's no way they could have had such victories other than by your hand. We thank you for the many ways that you show your mighty hand in our own lives, and we ask you to show us those and help us to have open hearts to recognize the times that you work in our lives and that you put your mighty hand into our lives to accomplish your good and to fulfill your plans. Help us to emulate the faith of Joshua and the people who the Israelites as they went into the promised land and did your work and followed your guidance and said, yes, we will obey, we will serve Yahweh our God. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.